Welcome to the Trino Community Broadcast.
Hello and welcome to Trino Community Broadcast 69. We're going to talk about spools today. Nah, just kidding. We talk about something about Trino as usual. And again, of course, my co-host Cole is joining me. Hey, Cole, how's it going?
Hello, hello. It's good to be back. It's exciting to be talking about what we're talking about. And it's also, I think, this is our closest follow-up to a past broadcast in a while. We're actually...
Yeah, you haven't seen nothing yet, man. You haven't seen nothing yet. We're lining up things. Like, we're already going to have another one about the preview UI that actually Mateusz, our guest today, also helped work with and is very active on, which is really awesome. But more about that in 2 weeks. And then afterwards, 2 weeks later again, we're talking about the Faker connected with Yarn. So it's rolling. There's so much stuff going on in the Trino community. I'm not even going to spoil what's coming up in Trino 470 because... that's also crazy. But what we're going to do is we're going to do a release update because we got 469 shipped, Cole. And that was a saga.
Yes. I saw the PR for it and I was like, okay, I see what's going on here.
Yeah. So what happened was we had Trino Summit, Trino Fest, and all that stuff happening in December. And then holidays and some merges, we ended up finding that there is a release breaker, a release blocker. So there was a breakage around bucketing. And it took us a while to figure out, A, where that even came from, and then who can even fix it and help with reviews. We had something merged that we didn't want to do that way. So we ended up backing that out. And so it was a whole bunch of like rigmaroling around. And in that time, the release ended up, let's just call it big, as you saw. So if you look at the release notes. Oh, no, that's the wrong button. Why does this not link?
Yeah, that was the right button. Oh, okay, there you go. Well.
So if you look at the release notes, if I make this a bit smaller, oops. It's a long one, right? So we're just going to talk about a few of the highlights, essentially, because, well, as you know, there's a link in the show notes, so you can just read it and like find out more. But... you want to tell us a bit about more of the stuff that's happening here?
Cool. Yeah, okay. So I'm looking at this. So we've got support for a bunch of different clauses when adding columns to tables in Iceberg MySQL and MariaDB.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting slash important because when tables, like, you know, like back in the day in Hive, there were like, you could only do certain things if columns like are in certain positions for like partitioning and that kind of stuff. Well, now you can actually decide that a new column gets added in certain positions.
Yeah, so it's first means it goes on the left, last means it goes on the right, and after is, you can specify which column to insert it after, yeah?
Yeah, so, and that seems to be important for performance and bucketing and that kind of stuff, especially also for Iceberg, obviously, that's what it was added for. It's also interesting that they ended up adding it to MySQL and MariaDB. I don't know exactly what the reasoning there is, but I guess if you go select star, then that's the default order. So it's maybe just nice.
Yeah, my hunch is that once we implement it in one place, we like say, well, it's a quick win to go get it in a few more. So
yeah. Yeah, but, also that's
a big deal as well because Iceberg offers that schema evolution as a key upside. It's kind of part of the Iceberg promise. So more control over schema evolution is useful for sure.
Yeah.
You're going to need to explain to me what SSEC is for security mapping.
Server-side encryption it's like basically it's a security setting for the new file system support that we used to have in the old one. And now it's in the new one as well. So it's deeper down in the weeds with the file system access, so not to worry about. What's more interesting, in my opinion, is the Google Cloud Storage, where you can now configure the endpoint. So typically, it would have been a certain Google URL, and it turned out that, you know, like for GovCloud on Azure, we needed to have an endpoint being able to configure that. Well, it turns out we needed it in Google as well. So there's Google users that run Google Cloud Storage on some other non-standard URLs as well somehow. And so it is important. For S3, of course, that was never an issue because S3 has all the S3 compatible ones. So they have all sorts of random URLs anyway. So.
But yeah, so that's if you're on Google Cloud Storage, using object storage or doing a lake or lakehouse, Trino can now connect to that as well. So
yeah, with the special URLs, right? Like the normal one always works. Yeah.
Yeah. But that helps it maintain its status as the Omni tool that can query anything. So
yeah, exactly. So it's helped for customers that use like, you know, load balance in front of Google Cloud Storage or like URL rewriting and things like that. So that's cool. Another thing that came was the JDBC driver now supports connection validation. So there's like an actual method for it that you can use. And there are also more stats available now from the JDBC driver's usage, which is interesting. Also interesting because it's a bit related to what we talk about later, the client protocol, but more about that later.
And then support for connector level event listeners is removed because there are better event listeners with Trino.
Yeah, like the global event listeners do everything basically. And we didn't have any connector level event listener. It was just an overhead and really didn't make sense. So like a connector level event listener would also be like only on certain catalogs and stuff. That it just didn't make sense. So we threw that out. It was some overhead. And then the Faker connector, again, as I mentioned, to the community broadcast in 4 weeks with Jan will tell us a lot more about that. It's been relatively new, that connector, like I want to say less than 6 months or so, but it's been really improving and it's a really nice little tool. So it's very, very excellent. And that's the releases. 470 is in the works already since like we got 469 out this week, but a lot of stuff has already merged. So it's very exciting, but I'm not going to spoil it because we'll want to talk about that in the next Trino community broadcast.
So when you're doing them every 2 weeks, there's only so many releases to go over.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, so it's been really good. So other news, we had another contributor call, which was very interesting and useful. Please do check that out if you haven't joined. It's interesting to see what other people are struggling with, what PRs they want. We had some people from Amazon join us to talk about some of the new file formats and stuff they want to have as readers and writers and stuff like that. So it's good to see all that collaboration. And then the other news is the Trino Python client had the 0.332.0 release. It's terrible why it is zero. I don't know. It's very stable and powerful. We might have to niche that to a one at some stage, but that's out and that supports spooling. And that gets me to our guest intro. Hey, Mateusz, it is great to have you on board.
You are muted.
Oh, yeah, sorry. There actually, this is my first time presenting anything about Trino, which is kind of surprising because I've been working on the Trino for the last 5 years. I had anniversary 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so, when I was writing the show notes, I was like, did we have you as guest yet? And I looked and like, yeah, it's crazy. But like you've been pretty active in the community, let's just say, and that's an understatement. So you've been at the contributor calls, you've been at Trino Summit, you regularly show up at contributor calls, you are a maintainer. Tell us a bit more, like people know you also as Wendigo. And when I look at the stats of last year and the year before and stuff, you're like ridiculously proliferant in the Trino
system.
What do you do?
That's true. So during the last couple of years, I had like a couple of like personal missions, the things that I tried to achieve. One of those was, for example, to get rid of the CVs in the code base. So I've been modernizing the whole code base from the bottom to the top, like starting with the Airlift Airbase, which are the frameworks that we use to build the Trino. Mm-hmm. Across all of the like dependencies in the server and in the connector space. So it took me like over 2 years to actually get to the point where we are using the latest dependencies. So that was one of my personal missions. The other one was to actually use the latest JDK. And this like also took me like around 3 years to like first move from Java 11 to Java 17, then from 17 to 21. And recently, we've decided that we will move like with the STS releases, adopting the tip model of Java development. So now we are on Java 23, but I already have the working 24 branch, which is going to be released in like 2 months from now. So we are already there, which is something that I am actually pretty fond of.
Yeah, no, like I've been working with you on the Java upgrades and doing like public messaging and stuff like that. And it's amazing to see each time how much benefit we get and what we can do with the new releases. It's totally been worth it. And I think it's great. Like we also like, I mean, I'm doing a little spoil now. In the 470 release, we upgraded the client tool requirements to require Java 11. And we did that via like obviously a pull request in development, but we also asked the community in a survey and stuff like that. And it's been really good. So I love working with you. Thank you so much for everything you do. You've gotten a lot of crazy cool stuff going. And today, what are we talking about today?
Today we'll be talking about the Spooling Protocol, which is a project that I've been driving for over a year now. It actually started in September, 1.5 years ago, with a bunch of prototypes that I built. The end goal of the project was to actually make sure that Trino would be able to like provide much higher throughput when you want to get some data out of the cluster. So that was basically the goal.
So it's a client protocol. So any application outside of Trino that talks to Trino uses that protocol.
Yes. Okay. This is one of the things that you called out with the Python client. We've recently added a support for the Spooling Protocol extension to the Python client.
And like history wise, didn't we already have a client protocol? Why we need another one?
The current protocol, what you call right now the direct protocol, is something that was created over 10 years ago and it was stable since. But it was always like kind of limited because due to the nature of how the protocol works, you couldn't get much higher throughput. So we wanted to get to the point where we can actually like move like huge data sets between, for example, clusters. And Starburst, we have something called the Stargate connector, which is the connector, basically Trino to Trino connector, but with the enterprise features. And this was our baseline developing this protocol extension. We wanted to get to the point where the throughput will be much higher. Mm-hmm. And we actually delivered because the new Stargate connector is like 20 times faster. So previously we had queries that were running for over 40 minutes to get the data out of the remote cluster. Now we can run the same queries in 2 minutes, which is kind of amazing. So
it's good for shuffling data from one Trino cluster to another.
Yeah, but also like every client application can benefit from these changes because the client will get more data in a single request. And this is something that I will show during the demo, that the latency between the client and the cluster matters a lot. And the new protocol basically overcomes some of the limitations of the direct protocol.
Yeah, so if I do like select star on a table that has a terabyte of data, my client will just get that data faster.
Yes.
It's to take faster. A while, Cole, if you ask a terabyte.
Oh, I understand. But like,
if you want to take 1 terabyte out of a cluster, I guess that you need to be really patient because it will take a long time.
Of course it will. But nonetheless, it's instead of being, a day, it might be hours.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
But like if you don't talk terabytes, this is still very like practical, I'm guessing, because lots of people these days do like loading a bunch of data locally on their workstation to munch around with it with like analytics and like ML and all that kind of jazz, which typically needs more data. And then also I'm guessing there is dashboards and like charts and stuff for that. If they have like scatter charts with lots and lots of data points, they can be pretty like heavy, right? Like that actually
basically
have a lot of data.
The use cases that Trino is used for basically changed over the years, right? When Presto was created, which is a predecessor for the Trino, like the main use case was analytics, so highly selective queries where you get pretty limited like set of rows, basically.
Yeah, but give me the top three, right?
Yeah, for example, like some aggregations over like some users or some countries or whatever, right? So you get you usually get like limited number of rows, so the like result set is small. But today, as you've said, these use cases are different. So we've seen around the industry the usage, like for example, the data extraction to the tools like Power BI or Tableau, where the analyst basically extracts that some data set from the cluster and then starts to working with it locally on his own machine. Because it's much faster than running like a series of queries, right? So you just like pre-extract data, some prepared like set of data, and then start to working with that locally.
Okay.
So cool. Yeah. So the use cases are different nowadays. That's why we started working on that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Trino being so good at federating data now, like has fault tolerant execution mode for ETL, ELT type workloads where it can handle ingesting data, writing data, transforming data in reasonably resilient ways that make it kind of super versatile, and all of that can be sped up.
Yes. So the Trino was always fast inside, but we wanted to make Trino fast outside, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's always more to do, as we saw in the last contributor call. There's now discussions about getting data in fast as well. So. Mateusz kicked off an avalanche. So when we talk about client applications there, you just mentioned the Python client. So that supports spooling now. We'll find out more about that. But then I think the main one is the JDBC driver, right? Like that's
yes.
The so one that's all in of the Kernel Corpus itself, right?
All of the Java-based clients right now support spooling out of the box. So if the server is configured to support spooling, then the client will automatically pick this protocol over the direct one.
Oh, that's cool. Do you want to show us some more what you put together there, maybe?
Yes. Okay. Can I start my slides?
Yes. Cool.
Okay, so we already touched some of the points here, but I will just like tell you what the overall structure of this presentation is. So I will go through the like designs of both the direct protocol and the spooling one. I will like show you the differences between the direct and spooling protocols. I will also discuss how to actually configure the server to use the spooling protocol, how to use the client to use the spooling protocol. I have a little live demo that basically shows how fast you can extract data, 1 million rows from the cluster, running both the direct and the spooling protocols with different encoding variants, and then like some summary basically of the things that we've already said. So.
All right, let make sure that me and Cole can interrupt you with questions as well, okay?
Sure. If you have any questions, just ask. This is like pretty condensed like matter because I spent over a year actually trying to understand the protocol. So, and we are discussing the protocol in like 30 minutes or 40 minutes. So you know, like there's a lot of like interesting like details that basically make the protocol what it is today. So yeah.
That's also, I guess, a good point when you say you spent the year understanding it. That's a reason why people shouldn't just go, oh, I'm going to write the driver myself in my language.
Yeah.
It's just a REST API. It's not.
Yes.
It's a lot more complicated than that. So please don't do that if you have a need for a JavaScript client or whatever. We have these clients in the Trino community, and they work, and we want to improve them together. So if you have a need for those, ping us on the community and we'll see what we can work on together.
Yeah, so like the direct protocol that we have right now, which was something that was created over 10 years ago in the early days of Presto, has something that we call like a streaming data retrieval semantics, which means that when the client sends a request, it follows the set of like a set of next URIs. So every response will point to the next URI. And the direct protocol, the next URI actually contains the data. So you're getting up to 1 megabyte of data on every request, which means that if you have, for example, 1 gigabyte of data to fetch, you need to basically send over 1,000 requests to actually get this 1 gigabyte of data, right? One of the big benefits of the Dagger protocol is that it works out of the box. So it doesn't require any particular configuration. It just works. It doesn't require any additional components in the system, which is like on one hand is pretty beneficial, but on the other hand, it only supports a single deployment architecture, which is coordinator oriented, which means that every piece of information, every piece of the result set will go actually through the coordinator. So the coordinator will fetch the data from the workers and then pass it to the client, which means that there is a lot of pressure on the coordinator node.
So do we actually see problems there where like the coordinator is overloaded? Like I know that we always say, well, all of the boxes should be pretty big and beefy, but is there use cases where the coordinator ends up being too small and you have to actually like give it more oomph basically?
Yeah, so the bigger the cluster in terms of the worker nodes, the bigger the coordinator needs to be, because the more queries you have, the more like CPU and IO pressure will be put on the coordinator. I will describe it in a minute, what this actually means. The Dagger protocol also works only with the JSON format. So basically there is no option to actually add something different than some other than coding. Which is also one of the things that we wanted to change. One of the big advantages of the Dagger protocol is that it for small result sets, it's actually like pretty. It has pretty low latency, so you will get those results like as soon as the workers will start producing the results. So it works best for highly selective queries which return small amount of data. But it's not so good for getting large data sets out of the cluster. And one of the hardest thing about the Dagger protocol is that it's extremely hard to change. I've spent countless hours polishing some bugs, some corner cases that emerged when I started changing the protocol to basically allow for the spooling extension to work. So there are a lot of small and tiny details in the code that are part of the protocol, and a lot of clients actually use those tiny details when they're like communicating with the Trino cluster. So it's super easy to actually break something. That's why we wanted to make the spooling protocol extensible to the point that you don't need to change protocol, you just like plug in some, for example, new encoding. And this is how usually the communication between the client and the Trino cluster will look like. So the client submits a query to the query submission endpoint. And in the return, it gets the next URI in the response that basically says you need to follow this URI to get next state and like partial data or just a state, because the query could be, for example, just queued. So the clients sends over and over the next URI request, gets an next URI and just follows back and forth the next URI. The coordinator itself is getting data always from the workers. And then, as I already said, the coordinator needs to encode the raw data to the JSON format. So the coordinator not only transmits the data between the workers and the clients, but also encodes the data to the final format, which like puts a lot of pressure on the coordinator in terms of the CPU that it needs to encode the data and IO, because it needs to first get the data from the worker and then push the data to the client.
How does the data get to the worker in the first place? And then how does it get from the worker to the coordinator? Like there's some other protocols involved, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so the data being sent between the coordinator and the worker, and worker and the workers is using the internal API, which is not part of the protocol. So it's not exposed to the clients, which means that we can freely change the communication protocol between the the nodes in the cluster, which is like a good thing because we can evolve this independently of the client protocol. What was the other
and part I'm guessing of the question? That's faster as well and like more like a binary format.
It's binary format. The data that is being transmitted between the nodes it's in a row format. So we have an abstraction called the page, which is a list of blocks. Block is basically a single column. And we have a serializer that basically takes this in-memory representation and serializes this to the like Y representation, which is like a stream of bytes. And then we have the serializer that deserializes this on the wire format to the in-memory representation. Okay, so it's something really specific to the Trino. Only the Trino understands this serialization format from these in-memory structures to the on the wire format.
Okay, that's good to know though. So my because that's one of the questions always people is like, why is it so inefficient and not using some binary format? Well, it is using a very highly efficient binary format in the cluster, right? So
in the cluster, yes.
And like changing that around would not help anything really. No. Like it's already super highly efficient.
Yes. It's just like a byte array, byte stream. So
yeah. My first question was, how does the data get to the workers? And I'm guessing that depends on the connector, right? Like if the connector is using a JDBC driver, then it comes via JDBC and then gets transferred into the internal format. And if it's, well, whatever else, then it gets read as a parquet file or whatever. But it always gets transferred into that internal format and then shuffled around to the coordinator.
So the engine only speaks this like page and blocks abstractions, right? So At the connector level, we have abstractions called, for example, the page source provider, which, like the name itself, like tells the story. Mm-hmm. You want to get a page from the source, right? So the whole engine operates on pages, and the coordinator, when it encodes the data, it gets the pages and then encodes to the JSON. How the data is actually get from the worker depends heavily on the query shape. Because every query will be like scheduled on the set of workers differently. So for example, if you have like the order by, global order by, then you will have a single node that will do this like order by, because you need to gather all of the like data from all of the workers, sort it in memory, and then you can pass it to the coordinator. So it depends on the query shape. Usually when there is no like a final sort, it will be spread across the cluster depending on the number of splits that can be generated at the lowest like stages. So it also depends on the connector implementation, right? Not every connector is parallel in nature. Not every connector can generate multiple splits, so you will get different behavior in the iceberg connector, which can generate split based on the number of files that you need to read during the execution, and you will get different execution when you read the data from the Postgres, for example.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when I look at that picture, that looks very chatty. So it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And also, like from what I understand, your arrow down is also basically a sequence, but it's also a time. Like,
yes.
So, like, how long do queries take, or how long can they take until they're finished? Like, is there like a restriction or?
There are a couple of restrictions. So there's a configuration, what is the maximum like amount of time that query can take. But there are also some timeouts when the client stops like pulling the data and the query is basically marked as abandoned. So it's every like piece of like that flow is configurable. So you can decide whether you allow like those long running queries or not.
Yeah, but if you want a lot of data out and it takes an hour, that's fine. It is not
So it's like a set. It's a streaming protocol. So as long as you will fetch the next URI, so you don't abandon the results, you will get another like piece of information, another partial result set. But it's always up to 1 megabyte, like the raw data encoded to the JSON format. So it's still around 1 megabyte of data. This is how the protocol works. So the latency is low if the result set is small. But the bigger the result set gets, the latency will increase, because this every request to the next URI has this head latency that results from your distance to the cluster, right? So I have, for example, if I will show this during the demo, that if I am a client in the Europe and I'm connecting to the cluster in the United States, I'm always paying those 250 milliseconds on every request. So if you sequentially need to fetch 1,000 next URIs, then you will pay 1,000 multiplied by 250 milliseconds, like totally.
Yeah.
Not like not counting the time to actually get the data, decode it, and so on.
And this flow here visualizes what's happening for one query for one user.
Yes, yes.
A typical coordinator is going to suffer under many queries from many users. So yes. It's going to be pretty busy to shuffle all that stuff.
Basically. Yes, yes. So it will basically act as a proxy between the client and the workers. So coordinator is only like passing the information around, doing the encoding to the final format being a JSON.
Yeah, but it also has to do the query planning and all sorts of other stuff. So
yes,
like,
yes.
The coordinator is a busy body.
Yeah, it is. So when we started working on the spooling protocol, one of our first basically objective was to make protocol that gives you much higher throughput. Of course, it's traded for some latency in some cases, but it's okay unless we are able to actually give you much higher throughput. We also wanted to basically support multiple deployment architectures. As I said, for the direct protocol, the coordinator is always acting as a proxy between the workers and the client. With the spooling protocol, you can actually choose between different deployment architectures where either the client goes to the coordinator for the data or goes to the storage directly, like the spooling storage, or goes to the worker, which acts as a proxy to the storage. So right now with the spooling protocol, you can actually choose what is like the best architecture for your particular use case. When we started implementation, one of the goals, like from the like code perspective alone, was to actually make sure that those changes will be easy to implement on the client side. We didn't want to like invent like everything from scratch, like create a new protocol, call it V2 or whatever, use some like I don't know protobuf or any other library, because it would require from us to implement this new protocol in every like language for every possible like kind of a client, including JDBC, ODBC, and so on. So instead, we wanted to make those changes as tiny and like basically as a like precise incision in the code, just like add something little, like create some things around it, and it should just work, right? So that was one of the big goals, to make sure that those changes are easy to implement on the client side without like breaking the existing application, without need to rewrite those client applications and so on. We also wanted, of course, to maintain backward and forward compatibility for the existing client, which means that we want the new client to be able to still to talk to the old server. We want the new client talk to the new server without spooling configured. You want a new client to talk to your old client to talk to the new server without spooling, old client to talk to the server with the spooling enabled. So regardless of your configuration, it should always work. So it will always fall back to the direct protocol if the client and the server couldn't negotiate the spooling protocol.
With this being like so kind of easy to implement on client side, do we have clients now? Like, have we made it so that the user can choose which protocol they want to use if both are supported by the client?
It's even it's even better than that, actually.
Are we automatically inferring which one to use based on?
Yeah. So the preference is always to use the spooling protocol because it's just gives you a higher throughput, and in the spooling protocol, you can have multiple encoding formats, which is like the last point here on the slide. So in the spooling protocol, you can have multiple encoding formats, being JSON with some compression, codec, or in the future, for example, Arrow or Parco or whatever format that you would like to actually add to the protocol. So So in the client, the spooling protocol is always preferred, and the client always sends a list of preferred encodings to the server. And the server can, based on its own configuration, can decide which encoding will be used, which is like shared between the client and the server, and this will be used for the duration of the query when the query is processed. So the client and server basically agree on the protocol and agree on the encoding format.
Okay, and the user doesn't even have to think about it generally?
No, cool. It's just automatic process, and there's always automatic fallback. If the server doesn't support spooling, then the client will get the direct protocol. If, the, for example, we have a new client that supports Arrow, but we've deployed all server that doesn't speak Arrow yet, then the spooling protocol will agree on the JSON format.
So, just to show everyone a bit, like this is on the Trino website, but like we have these official drivers, right? Like there's .NET, Go, JavaScript, JDBC, and Python. Those are the official clients that we maintain in the Trino community. And then there's these other client drivers that others stakeholders have made. But then we also have all these client applications, right? So there's basically a lot going on, and like having to go and work with all these people. If there's a completely new protocol and a new driver and everything, that would have been a lot of work and like
yes.
just delayed rollout tremendously. And that's why the approach that Mateusz ended up designing is like super good, really.
Yes. And actually when I finished the JDBC driver with the spooling protocol, I just dropped it to the DBver and just tried it, and it worked out of the box. So usually you would just upgrade the library, like JDBC driver or the client library, and it will work out of the box.
Yeah,
as long as you're of course configured the server to support the spooling. Okay, so when I started working on that, the first thing that I actually did was to build a couple of prototypes in order to actually understand what needs to be done, how to actually change the protocol, what is the minimum set of changes in order to actually enable this this extension to exist. And what we decided to do is actually introduce a single header, single extra header that is used to negotiate the spooling protocol between the client and the server. And we changed a shape of the data field that is part of the response when you call the next URI. So previously, the next the data field was always a JSON URI, which contains a data. Right now, it could be also an object that contains a definition of segments. Segment is just like a new like term for the partial data. And in the spooling protocol, you have two types of segments. You can either have an inline segment, which is similar to the existing direct protocol when you get a partial result set with the next URI call. And you can have the spot segment, which is this new thing that actually allows you to increase the throughput and even read the data in parallel, because the spot segment is basically a URI to the data. So instead of pushing the data through the coordinator, you can get an URI to the data, and the client will just fetch this, just do an ordinary HTTP GET to this URI, and will get this segment representing some partial result set. We also decided that we will just stick to the existing JSON encoding because it's also it's much easier to roll out support for the spooling protocol when you don't need to change like every like thing like encoding format. So we already have JSON encoding that works. We know how to both encode and decode data. So it was much easier to like start with that, change the protocol, introduce those spool segments, and use the existing JSON encoding. Doesn't require any changes. It just required like plugging the code to the new place. As I already said a couple of times, the protocol and encoding negotiation supports a graceful fallback. So if the client and the server cannot agree on some common definition of the encoding and the protocol, the client will always fall back to the direct protocol. We introduce a one SPI, which is called the Spooling Manager. A Spooling Manager is a being that is responsible for spooling the data to the storage, that's how the client can get the data. The data is basically spooled on the storage, and the client gets an URI to this data. We also decide that the initial implementation, the one spooling manager that exists today, will be based on the native file system implementation, because we already had the code that stocks the S3 Azure Blob file system and GCS. So it was much easier to implement spooling manager based on the existing code because it was already there. So it took like 2 days to implement the spooling manager that talked those three storage systems. The only thing that we added there was the support for pre-signed URIs generation. So we have one deployment option that allows you to basically go directly to the storage without ever going through the coordinator. And the spooling protocol allows you to add new encodings schemes seamlessly, which means that you can drop new encoding in both client and the server. And if they agree on that they have this capability, it will be like used. But if they don't have the same encoding schemes, only the common ones will be used. So you can, for example, drop the Arrow encoding on the server. And if the client is too old and doesn't speak Arrow, it will still use the JSON encoding. You can add the Arrow support to the server, and if you have a new client with the Arrow support, it will like be chosen and used. So and this is like, it doesn't require like changes to the protocol. You just drop an implementation to the server, and it will just be possible to use. So
on the spooling manager SPI, that's for people that need to implement another object storage to use on the server, right? Like a normal user doesn't need to worry about that.
Not only the other like storage system, but we've been also talking about the use cases when you actually want to get the data from the workers, right? So It's possible to implement the spooling manager that will persist this partial results on the worker nodes, and the URI that you will get will point to the worker node, basically.
So like on local disk on the worker.
Yes. But there's, of course, a limitation there. We also assume that the spooling storage is unbounded. Mm-hmm. So it's basically unlimited in space because we didn't want to like create some sort of like back pressure system that would, either slow down the queries or something like that. The assumption is that this like spooling storage that we use for spooling, it's unlimited. Of course, we are trying to use the space as efficiently as possible. That's why we've introduced the JSON encoding with compressed variants to basically make sure that the data that is being stored on the storage is as small as possible. Also, is as small as possible to transmit over the network.
Yeah, but also,
yeah,
like it's not that the storage needs to keep growing, right? It's just transient, right? Like it's like written into it, and then the client reads it, and then it gets deleted. So it's not like it keeps growing and it has all the old stuff. It's more like it's kind of a cache. It's not really not traditionally a cache.
Yes,
it's like a handle through of that of the elements.
Yes, it's basically a buffering place, like a buffering storage. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I already said that we've changed the definition of the data feed. So this is how it looks like in comparison between the direct and the spooling protocol. In spooling protocol, we have this header called Xtrino Query Data Encoding, which says that the client wants to use the spooling protocol with given list of supported encodings by the client, and then the server can choose one of the encodings in the preferred order. And if the server and the client agrees on the usage of the spooling protocol, the data feed will change its shape from the JSON array to the JSON object that will contain some additional information about the encoding that was negotiated between the client and the server and the list of segments. So that basically means that previously in a single next URI call, you would get 1 megabyte of data. But here in this new protocol, you can actually get a list of segments, which is, there's no limit to the list of segments. You can get I don't know, 100 segments in a single next URI call. And those segments can represent gigabytes of data. Of course, it depends on how fast the workers can are able to spool the data. But if the workers are like pretty fast and the storage is fast and the query processing is fast enough, then you can get like multiplies of hundreds of megabytes in a single next URI call.
Well, crazy.
Yeah, and there, as I already mentioned, there are two types of segments. You can either get an inline segment, which is something that we start producing initially to decrease the latency for the first like hundreds of rows that you will get, to make sure that we won't spool the data if the result set is rather small, right? So if you have like query that produces 100 rows, you don't want to spool them right away because it doesn't make sense to store small objects on the spooling storage because it costs some money to basically write read data from the storage and keep the file object there. So for a couple of initial rows, that these will be inlined, and once we cross some threshold, it will start, the workers will start spooling the data. And the spooled segment is basically three pieces of information, which is the URI that the client will just send a HTTP GET request to a given location to get the byte stream with the encoded data. There is the ACK URI that basically the client sends also the HTTP GET request to explicitly acknowledge that the segment was read, so the server can just remove it asynchronously to, as you've said, to basically keep the storage usage low. And there are a set of headers that the client just sends along with those requests. The client doesn't need to do anything with those informations. It just sends them with the ordinary HTTP GET without any additional like interpretation changes. That's self-contained, it's totally opaque, so it can point to multiple different places. It can point to the coordinator, it can point directly to the storage. From the client perspective, it doesn't make any difference because it's just an URI that you need to like send requests to. And that's basically it. Cool. So the new flow is basically similar to the existing protocol, with the difference that instead of getting the data when you call the next URI, you will get a list of segments, right? And the grantor is no longer getting a raw data from workers. It's getting only this segment location, segment information from the workers. So the worker is basically spooling the data to the storage and passing along only metadata that represents this particular segment, like the encryption keys, the URI, the ACK URI, any metadata that client that needs to have in order to actually decode the data, like the encoding scheme, whether it's compressed or not, what is the uncompressed size, what is the segment size, in order to make sure that you've read enough bytes from the network. So Corinter is no longer doing an NIO. It's no longer participating in like transmitting data between the workers and the clients. Workers are just spooling that, and the client goes directly to the spooling storage if configured to do so. And also, Corinter is no longer doing the encoding, because encoding to the final format being a JSON happens also on the worker nodes. So basically, we've moved the I/O and CPU from the Corinter to the worker nodes, and it's much easier to scale out the cluster by adding more worker nodes rather than having a bigger and bigger coordinator node, right?
Yeah, especially for like those large Trino clusters. Like,
yes,
servers only get so big, but you can always get more servers. So
yes.
When like, this is actually super fascinating because you're scaling out how quickly your client can receive information now. Yes. By adding more worker nodes, your client becomes a bottleneck rather than any aspect of the Trino cluster.
Yeah, and our benchmarks, when we are, for example, transmitting 10 gigabytes of data from out of the cluster, the the data that is moved like through the coordinators around like 40, 50 kilobytes, which is like the representation of the segment URIs. So, so we basically eliminated like majority of IO that coordinator was doing. It only gets those like metadata information about the segment's locations and just like returns it to the client. So coordinator finally can do what it was intended to do, being like the planning of the queries, accepting query submissions, like keeping track of all of the queries that are running in the cluster, making sure that they are head to the resource limits and so on. So so this like improves a lot of things, but also changes the like the overall like architecture of the cluster.
With this, can you reach a point where your client network bandwidth is actually the bottleneck rather than anything to do with Trino?
Yes, actually, this is the case. Like I'm usually, when I'm changing anything in the HTTP server, I usually run the internal benchmark suit, which is called the throughput benchmark. And throughput benchmark is basically sending as many small queries as possible to the coordinator to basically saturate the coordinator in terms of the scheduling and also workers in terms of the processing. And usually the bottleneck will be network. So the Trino cluster is usually able to saturate the network between the nodes and also coordinator node. So yeah.
Cool. Hey, so I have a couple of observations from this diagram and questions. So tell me if I'm wrong. So when you say segment location is transferred from the worker to the coordinator, that's just a link. Like it's just very little, it's very little data. So the whole talking in between workers with the coordinator is like very much reduced already.
Yes. Yes. It's just kilobytes of data rather than gigabytes.
Yeah. So that's the first one. The second one, the talk when the coordinator talks to the client, that's also then just like links basically and metadata. So yes. A, it's a lot less, and B, it's probably also going to be faster, right?
Yes, yes, because you don't encode the data to this final format. You are not fetching megabytes of raw data from the worker nodes. You are getting small pages. These are basically like 50 bytes of data that represents a single like segment. And segment can represent, it's also configurable how big the segment is, but segment usually will be between 2 megabytes and 128 megabytes. So you send 50 bytes of data that represents a segment location to represent up to 128 megabytes of data, actual data. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a ratio that we can have here.
So that's literally like a very big change then on the demand for the worker and for the cluster internal communication.
Yes, and that's one funny side effect when I started implementing this that I actually wasn't aware before, that when you are processing the query, we didn't take into the account the time spent on the coordinator node to get the results from the workers, and we didn't account for the CPUs to encode the data. So basically, it was a kind of gray zone. In the query statistics, you could only see the statistics generated on the worker nodes, but the time spent on both IO and CPU to get data to the client was never accounted for in the query statistics. And now in the spooling protocol, it's actually accounted for, so you can see how much time was spent, how many CPU cycles were spent to actually encode the data to this final format being JSON right now, but or in the future or any other format. And you also see how much time is spent to actually spool the data. And this is actually makes it harder to compare the spooling protocol to the direct one if you take a look at the statistics, because you will see also this JSON encoding time, which is something that isn't accounted for in the direct protocol.
Yeah, one of my questions was going to be, like, there is this throughput for latency trade-off.
Yes.
Like, how much does this impact latency?
It depends on the query, right? Because if the result set is rather small, then getting data through the coordinator would be probably faster, because you don't need to like spool the data, so you don't have this latency between the worker and the storage, and then client and the storage. So it depends heavily on the query shape. We added this like inline segment thing just to make sure that we don't spoil small results. So for the small queries, we will usually just inline the data and the response as we do today, and then just start to spoil data once we cross a certain threshold. The threshold is also part of the configuration, so you can decide whether you want to inline segments or not. You can decide how many rows will be inlined, what is the maximum size of the data that will be inlined. But other than that, this is a way to actually try to reduce this latency trade-off that exists in this protocol.
Okay, so if I submit like a highly selective analytical query that gives me one row,
yeah, you will get inline. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then there's no trade-off at all. It just goes the whole way.
Yeah, because it doesn't make sense to like spoil like a single like digit. response. Yeah.
All right. I have one more question about this diagram, and that is that sneaky little line, the sneaky long dotted line at the bottom that goes from the client to the storage. So that means that whatever that storage is, and we said it's like Azure, GCS or S3 compatible stuff, the workers write to it and then the client reads to it. So it must be accessible in like by both.
Client. Yes and no. Yes and no. It's up to the configuration because we have different deployment modes. So you can actually decide whether the client will go directly to the storage, which is the storage retrieval mode. And that basically means that you will avoid like calling
that's
every...
That's the fastest, right?
Yeah, that's the fastest option because you will go directly to the storage using pre-signed URI. And you will get data immediately from the storage itself. But there are certain like deployment scenarios when this is not possible because storage is hidden like from the client. So you then need to go through the coordinator. This is also an option. So you can basically like use the coordinator as a proxy to the storage. Mm-hmm. And you can also have an option when the worker node is used as a proxy to the storage. So it's up to the deployment use case to decide what is the retrieval mode. Like every retrieval mode is different. I have a slide on that as well. So I think that we will get to it.
Cool. But in all cases, it's completely secure.
Yes. In every case, it's always using I think that I have this on this slide or maybe not. Anyway, so the implications for this like new protocol is that the data encoding is moved from the coordinator to the workers, which are doing this like final transformation from the raw in-memory representations to on-the-wire JSON encoding format or any other encoding format. This data handoff, so proxying the data between the worker and the client, is also moved to the spooling storage, which is usually it's easier to scale than the network. Or the number of worker nodes that you have. The segments that are created on the storage are spooled as fast as possible with little or no buffering. And there's an asterisk because we don't want to spool like too many small segments, so we try to buffer them up to the certain size, to coalesce them to the certain size. So we rather prefer to create bigger segments rather than like a lot of small ones, because usually on the object storage systems, you will pay for a single object that is being stored. So it's just much more beneficial to actually store bigger segments rather than a lot of small ones. It's also from the client perspective, it also makes sense to have bigger segments than the small ones. One of the things that maybe it's not visible on this diagram is that the client doesn't need to fetch the segment during the query like lifespan. The client needs to fetch the information about the segment location, so it needs to follow the next URI. But there's no mechanism that basically prohibits the client to read the segment, even if the query is already finished.
So the coordinator's finished state from the coordinator's perspective is like, I've given you all the information, we are done here, but the client is like, I'm still busy loading all this stuff.
Yes, yes, exactly. So, which also means that the resources associated with the query processing will be fed much faster because the client got all of the segment locations and the query is finished, so we can like move to other query and the client can read in its own pace, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the big issues that we from time to time was asked on either Slack on the GitHub issues, why the query is still in the finishing state. And this is because of that particular like reason. Client needs to get the last next URI and actually for the query to be marked as finished. Mm-hmm. And so it also means that it needs to read like the whole result, right? And for the spooling protocol, it's no longer a case because if your client gets a segment URI, it can just like buffer it like on the client side, iterate like until the end of the query, until the query is finished, and then just read the data on its own pace. Like, so the slow client it's not longer causing the cluster to keep all of those resources associated with the query processing. So the cluster can be as fast as possible, and the client can be as slow as it wants, basically.
So by the way, we have a question coming from LinkedIn chat, but I think we've got to move on. Where can we ask questions about this if we want to follow up?
Slack is a good choice, I guess.
Okay, so the Trino Slack. Do you have a channel on there for discussion about this?
No, just the normal channels. I think it's
okay. Fine. I think the normal channel, like the troubleshooting or some like beginner like channels, are good enough.
Okay.
Also, we also have some questions, and I think we do have time to ask these questions.
Oh, okay.
Worst case, we're a bit longer. Like, if it's a great topic that interests a lot of people, we should just like rip it up.
Okay.
I also have a question here from Saju actually, and there's a whole discussion happening. And he's like, can we use a proxy to manage the client protocol storage communication? Sean is chiming in about the four modes, but Saju is actually thinking about an external proxy, and I was then thinking, well, maybe that external proxy could be Trino Gateway, and John is like, that's a good question. So now it's up to you to figure this out.
So that's why we've made the spooling manager as an SPI, so you can actually implement those different like scenarios for your own like use cases, right? So if you need like a proxy or any other like kind of a like deployment like architecture, then it's possible to either like use the existing configuration to achieve that or for example, implement your own like spooling manager that supports like proxying or whatever.
Yeah, so we could implement a spooling manager that supports proxying into and / via the Trino Gateway, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh. Yeah, and as I already also said like a couple of times, the client usually will get more data in a single next URI call. It doesn't mean that the next URI call would be like bigger, like will be a bigger response. It just means that the response will represent more data. So in the direct protocol, it's always up to 1 megabyte of data that is encoded to the JSON format. But in the spot protocol, you can get multiple segments that in a single next URI call, which means that you can get a representation of gigabytes of data in a single next URI call. Mm-hmm. And the client needs to go through this like segments, fetch them, decode them, and do whatever it needs to do with the data that is there. But as also said a couple of times, the segment can be read even if the query is already finished. So the client can take as much time as needed to actually process the data.
But because the data won't disappear off the object storage until it's been read.
Yeah, until it's being read and acknowledged, or it expires, because there is also a configuration option to basically say how long the segment on the storage can be read. So you can set like, I think that the default is 12 hours, but it can be like any number. So we can like set it to 1 year and the segment will never expire, or set it to 1 hour. So you have 1 hour to actually read the segment. And if the segment expires and the client didn't read it and acknowledge it, there is a mechanism on the coordinator node that basically goes through the expired segment and removes it from the storage. So So there is like a cleanup process that basically removes this, the old unread segments from the storage.
Awesome.
Yeah, and one also like that change that the thing that wasn't possible on the old protocol is that you can have the configurable compression variants for the JSON encoding and any other encoding if you implement this. So out of the box right now, we have three encoding scheme, which is JSON, JSON with Z standard, and JSON with SZ4. And this this overall like improves this throughput with some like small inch latency penalty. Okay, so let's go to the configuration itself. So in order to enable spooling protocol on the server side, you need to, first of all, enable the spooling protocol, which is a protocol spooling enabled configuration flag. Then you need to create a spooling manager properties file, which is similar to the other like access control properties and other like pieces of configuration. So it's a standalone properties file. In that file, you basically choose the spooling manager SPI implementation. The one that we ship right now, it's called File System, which is using the native File System implementation to spool the data. And the rest of the options, like the FS S3 enabled, FS location, FS segment, that are used to basically point to the particular like file system implementation and the location. And as also I said before, you can configure the segment time to live duration. So after this duration has passed, the client won't be able to read the segment, and the segment will be pruned from the storage. There are of course multiple other like configuration options specific to every file system implementation, but these are shared between the Hive Delta Lake Iceberg connectors that are using the native file system. So these are exactly the same options. So if you want, I don't know, like S3 endpoint configuration or region, you can use those configuration properties. We have support in JDBC, ODBC, which is delivered by Starburst, CLI, Java, and Python clients right now. The data, the segments are always encrypted on the storage. So in C2, they are always encrypted. We're using mechanisms on every storage provider, which is called the SSECE, which is server-side encryption customer key, which means that we are generating ephemera keys per every segment, sending this key to the storage along with the data. The data is encrypted by the storage provider itself, by the S3 Azure NGCS, so it always stays encrypted on the storage, and the client gets this ephemeral key and he is using that to when it's getting the segment. So without this encryption key, which is known only to the client that submitted the query, you can fetch you could fetch the segment, but you couldn't decrypt it. Cool. This server side encryption is actually a pretty good option because the client doesn't need to understand the encryption at all. It just needs to know how to send the header. And that's basically it. So there's no need to implement some encryption schemes on the client side, which is like from it's the like fancy rollout perspective is fine because you don't need to like write more code. And if the encryption scheme changes, you don't need to rewrite the clients and so on. So if there's like, some quantum computer will break as encryption, then probably the S3 will roll out some other encryption scheme or will start generating other like keys and it will still work without any changes to the client. So it's pretty good. And also it's good from the perspective that the CPU that is needed for encryption, the encryption is also on the storage side. So basically encryption is free. And from what I can tell is that there is no performance penalty, so it should work as fast as getting unencrypted data from the storage.
Cool.
The other option that we can set on the server side. Oh, I also forget to mention that the spooling manager properties and the spooling configuration needs to be applied to both coordinator and workers nodes. So it's basically a cluster-wide configuration. We also have this protocol spooling retrieval mode setting, which basically is this setting that controls the architecture, like deployment architecture of the spooling protocol. And we have four different modes for the file system spooling manager, which are the storage retrieval mode, which means that the client will go directly to the spooling storage because it will get pre-signed URI from the coordinator. Those pre-signed URIs are generated on the worker nodes when the data is spooled, and the client will get pre-signed URI. You just need to do an ordinary HTTP GET request with the set of headers that it got with the response, and that's basically it. Those headers will contain the decryption keys that the storage will use to decrypt the data. So there's a single request to the to the storage, which is the fastest option. We also have the coordinator storage redirect, which is something that allows you to control this, like whether client like goes to the coordinator or not to get the pre-signed URI. So instead of returning a pre-signed URI, we're returning a URI to the coordinator, and coordinator will generate pre-signed URI, which can have like the shorter time to live than the TTL of the object itself. So this works in cases when we want to make sure that the pre-signed URI has a shorter TTL than the object itself on the storage, like for some security reasons. Mm-hmm. And this requires two hops, because on the first request, client will be redirected to the second URI. So basically, these are like two requests. We also have the coordinator proxy, which means that the coordinator will be basically a proxy between the storage and the client. So the client will call the coordinator URI, and the coordinator will fetch the data from the storage and just return it to the client. So it puts some additional pressure on the IO pressure on the coordinator, but it doesn't like use the CPU because data is already encoded to the final format on the storage. So there is no CPU use here as in the direct protocol. And we also have the worker proxy retrieval mode, which means that the client will first send a request to the coordinator. Coordinator will pick one of the available workers, and the worker will act as a proxy to the storage. So there will be a redirect to one of the worker nodes that will act as a proxy. And this is useful in the situation when we don't want to expose storage to the clients directly, but we also don't want to make coordinator a single node that will act as a proxy. So this is an option when we want to spread this IO like pressure across the worker nodes.
But you then need to expose the workers, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So they're all a bit different in terms of architecture and like distribution of load and stuff like that. So you can pick and choose what you need, basically.
Yes, that's why we implemented those four options, just to make sure that we can support multiple like security environments. So we will have environments that the client can only see the coordinator, so we'll use the coordinator proxy. We will have situations when you can expose the storage directly. And this is, for example, the Starburst Galaxy, where we can actually expose the storage directly to the client, because like the whole communication happens over the public network. Mm-hmm. You can have the storage redirect, which allows you to shorten the pre-signed URI to adhere to some, for example, security policies in the company. And you can have the worker proxy if the worker is exposed to the client.
Cool.
Okay, so now I hope that my demo will work, hopefully.
We have the cool demo sound. Let's go.
Okay. Let's hope that it works. So I have two clusters running in Starburst Galaxy, which is the managed Trino basic infrastructure that we have here in Starburst. I have created two clusters that have spooling enabled. One cluster is in the United States, which is like pretty far from Europe, and the other one is pretty near the Poland where I live, in the Frankfurt. So let's first check whether those clusters are alive because they maybe could go down.
You're using the Trino CLI there straight from the jar.
Yes. So I think that we need to wait like for a couple of seconds or maybe a minute or two because those clusters were scaled down, so they need to start.
Well, we can wait for that while and Cole can ask that question from LinkedIn that he saw.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, this was going back to that last slide. It was we had a question about using an external proxy rather than an internal proxy.
Can you repeat the question?
So it's specifically the question was, can we use an external proxy to manage the client to storage communication?
Not yet, but I think that we can add this option.
So, Sadru, to answer the question, eventually.
Yes, eventually. Okay, so my first cluster just started. And another one also started. So it took like 30 seconds to basically start those two clusters, one in the States, another one in Europe. I hope that you actually can see my font.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Okay. And let's measure some latency so we can see how far we are from both clusters. So in terms of the Frankfurt cluster, we are basically 160 milliseconds from the cluster. And in terms of the North Virginia, we're around 430 milliseconds from the cluster, which is like pretty high latency. And let's run a Trino CLI with basically an output format node, which means that we will discard the data, we will fetch it, but we will just throw it away, with the encoding being null, which means that we've disabled the spooling. This is a CLI option that allows you to basically force the encoding. And if you like specify the empty encoding, it will just fall back to the direct protocol. And we will just select 1 million rows from the line item TPCH table. I also added here a network logging equals basic, which is an option that basically prints out on the terminal every request that is being sent by the client. So as you can see, the query was submitted, and now we are just fetching those next URIs over and over again. The statement is in the executing state, so we will call like a lot of next URIs. And finally, after like probably like 20 or 25 seconds, we'll get the whole 1 million rows from the direct protocol. Yeah, so it took 28 seconds. You need to like take into the account that I'm right now using Wi-Fi, so probably there is some like additional latency because of that. Usually in some offices, you probably use some like more stable connection. So this was 28 seconds for the direct protocol. Now we will run this spooling protocol with the JSON encoding. And as you can see, almost right away, we are calling different URIs because right now we are calling this pre-signed URI that basically goes directly to the storage. Even if you copy the URI from the screen, it's useless because the client is not printing headers here, and headers are used to decrypt the data. So like those URIs alone doesn't mean anything. And you can also see that those segments are actually much bigger than the 1 megabyte. So the final segment is around 18 megabytes. The previous ones are 32 megabytes. This is the configuration that we set the maximum size of the segment. So in this particular single present URI, we got 32 megabytes of data. So it took 9 seconds. Now we run the JSON with Z standard. It would also take around like 8-9 seconds. And the CLI, we use the new native compression decompression, the same on the server side. So if you're running CLI or GDPC on Java 22, it will use the new foreign function and memory interface to call the native compression decompression codecs, which are like way faster than the Java implementation.
So we are raising the minimum requirement for the CLI and the JDBC driver to 11.
Yes. But it also...
But it's beneficial to run it with the latest.
Yes, yes, exactly. So if you're running with Java 22, either for the JDBC or the CLI, it will automatically switch to the native decompression. So for the JSON with the IZ4, we also got around like 8 seconds. Now we will do the same query against the US cluster, which is those 400 milliseconds from the client. And we will also see that this latency adds up. So every next URI will take this another like 300, 400 milliseconds, which means that the farther you are from the cluster, the longer you will get the data in the direct protocol, because those latencies will add up due to the fact that the data fetching is streaming, it's sequential. So you need to call every next URI like when you get one. So
yeah, so there's some cable on the Atlantic Ocean right now. And it's going
yes, ding, yes.
And then you send the next doot as it goes back and forth across the Atlantic.
Yes. So we have to, if you have this higher latency between your client and this and the cluster, then the spooling protocol would be much faster than the direct protocol, especially for huge queries. So previously we had like 20 seconds, now we have like 41, and this is due to the fact that we have this like additional latency for every request that we need to send to the cluster. So let's run with the JSON encoding. This should also take around like 10, 11 seconds, maybe more, it depends on the network. So 13 seconds with decompression, it should take maybe like a second or two less. This particular result set is not that big. It's 1 million rows, so it's not super like huge. It's just like a couple of hundreds of megabytes. So,
and would we see like this ratio here is kind of, you know, like in that 3-5x ish zone?
Yeah. So where... so that's basically a summary that without spoiling the European cluster will like take around 28 seconds to fetch the data over the direct protocol. It will take around 9 seconds, 8.5 seconds with the spooled protocol. And in the States, due to the like the distance and the this latency of a request, the direct protocol will take 40 seconds and it will take 9 seconds. So similar to the European cluster, the latency here just adds to those like small like number of like segment fetches.
And if this data set was bigger, we would see a larger difference in these results, yeah?
Yes, usually yes. Because like, as I said, like if you have 1 gigabyte of data to fetch, you need to call next URI 1,000 times. So if you add like 50 milliseconds to every request response, then it multiplies by the number of requests. So the bigger the result set is, the higher the bigger the difference will be between the direct and the spool protocol.
Sash is also asking a related question: is the segments retrieval parallelized on the client side? And I guess the answer is it depends on the client.
It depends on the client. So in JDBC, we have like a prefetching queue. So we will try to fill some internal like queue to basically fetching the next segment. I forget to mention that, but the segments are always returned in the order of the specified by the query result, by the query shape, right? So the data is ordered, you will get segments in order as well. But it's up to the client to decide whether it wants to read the data in order, or maybe it can like read the data in parallel, like without like taking care about the order at all, right? So it's up to the client. In the Python application, we actually expose the ability to iterate over segments. So we don't need to read rows as you do in a JDBC driver. You can read segments and you can like, I don't know, like send it to multiple workers and the workers can read the data in parallel. So it's up to the client application actually. And JDBC, you will always like fetch the next row, right? Because that's how the JDBC works. We try to prefetch some data in JDBC application, but the queue is like rather small. It's like 100,000 rows, I think. I don't think that in JDBC it would make that difference, because in JDBC you're always iterating over rows. So,
cool. Wow, that's super impressive.
Okay, so some final like thoughts. So the spooling protocol is marked as non-experimental. I'm not saying that it's like stable and final. The protocol is finalized, like the communication like scheme is finalized. The configuration can probably change, maybe. I don't have anything like on the like short end that needs to be done there, but the protocol itself is stable, so the client can implement it without like worry that this will change and will break some client applications. Also, the SPI is stable, so the spooling manager SPI won't change, and if it does, it will like be a like for backward compatible change. The spooling protocol coexists with the direct protocol, so it's always forward and backward compatible with the different like client applications that can be either support spooling or not. The segment retrieval is always streaming, so on every next URI call, you will get some list of segments. So the like the protocol still is like a streaming one. You need to call next URI, but you will get multiple segments in a single next URI call. It requires this spooling storage configuration, so we need to actually do something. You need to have a configured storage, spooling storage. You need to create a configuration for this storage on the cluster side. But there is a lot of configuration options, whether to allow inlining or not, what is the something that we call initial segment size. So at the beginning of the query, we'll produce rather small segments just to make sure that we don't increase latency. But the more data is produced, the segments will get bigger over time up to the specified maximum segment size. So we will like start producing, for example, 1 megabyte segments, then 2 megabytes, 4 megabytes, 8 megabytes, up to, I don't know, like 20, 56 megabytes. And there are a lot of session properties that also control those like these particular behaviors, and a lot of like options around these deployment architectures. Right now, we only support the JSON format with those compressed variants, but I've already started working on the arrow, some like prototype. There are a bunch of things that we need to do in order to actually like make an arrow a first class citizen in the protocol, but I think that discussion is ahead of us right now, so we should see how it goes. The server side encryption with ephemeral per segment encryption keys is always on. This is a default, so the data will be always encrypted on the storage. So we need to both have the pre-signed URI or the current or location URI and the encryption keys and the headers to actually be able to read the data. And of course, the latency will be in some cases higher than the direct, but the throughput will be much, much higher. And it also means that you will get results much faster than in the direct protocol. I said most of those things already, so maybe we can like skip it. Couple of things that actually I think that is worth to mention is that I did a lot of improvements on the decoding and encoding side when we are converting those raw pages to the JSON and then decoding JSON to the like list of objects on the JSON on the CLI and JDBC side, and I ported those improvements to the direct protocol as well. So you should actually see some improvement in the direct protocol as well. So in this particular case, when I was doing a demo, I was comparing the spooling protocol versus optimized direct protocol. So it's so if we would take like the old server, the difference should be even higher because I've applied a lot of optimizations to the direct protocol as well based on the things that I've built for the spooling protocol. One of those things, for example, is this new streaming JSON decoding decoder encoder, which means that we are no longer buffering the JSON representations in memory. So we can like read the data from the stream and we can write to the stream without buffering. So it's much faster. I actually wrote the JSON parser that is just using JSON tokens. So we're no longer using object mapper from JSON. We are like parsing tokens. So we understand the structure of the JSON and we basically like tokenize and read tokens. So pretty low level stuff, but it's actually pretty fast and it's using less memory. And it's also lazy. So you only decode the rows that you actually read. If you stop reading, you stop decoding. So you're not wasting time there. We also enabled faster decimal and floats parsing in JSON, which is something that we didn't do before. I don't know why, but I think that we just missed this optimization. One of the cool things that I discovered is that when we are writing char var binaries to the streams, to the JSON, we are actually doing something really stupid because we are taking a slice, which is in our representation of those types. We are converting this to the bytes, so we can convert this to the string, and then the JSON is taking string and converting this back to the bytes. So instead of like doing these conversions, we are taking a slice and writing this directly to the output as a UTF-8 JSON. So there's no longer a lot. It's like back and forth conversion between different types. It's basically direct memory to on the wire write. We also added a couple of special properties to control the inlining and the segment sizes. And this is something that is part of the 469 release. The demo that I showed you is on the 468, because it's the version that we have in Galaxy right now. And in 470, I don't think that there are some changes there. So this probably is the 469 has all of the things that I already said. I'm working right now on the prototype for the RO encoding. And we still have on the list like support in other client libraries like JavaScript, C# or Golang. So this is yet to be done.
Very, very exciting.
And that's basically it.
Awesome. Well, Mateusz, that was very, very interesting. It's definitely a very worthy follow-up to the deep dive on the Python UDF we did with David last time, where we also had our heads smoking. I think we're having our heads smoking again, but this is super impressive. And I think it's going to be a massive impact for the Trino community users that munch around with a lot of data, and there's a lot of them.
Yes.
So I think it's very exciting.
So I'm thinking about those use cases where for example, you want to train the machine learning model, right? You want to extract like some data out of the cluster. You get a list of segments, then you can like feed those lists of segments to some like machinery that basically trains the model, yeah. Right? And the direct protocol, it would be possible, but it would be also extremely slow. And the Spori protocol, it can get much faster. There were also a lot of questions about the RO flight protocol. To be honest, I don't think that we will ever implement RO flight in the server itself, because it would leak the RO like abstractions to the server. But I think that it's actually possible to implement a proxy like the RO flight server that will talk the spooling protocol to the cluster and talk the RO flight to the client. Yeah. And then you have if we add the RO encoding to the server, to the spooling protocol, then you can just like get those RO segments and just like
wrap yeah, it that's into the that's RO only interesting and... for people that need binary RO data.
Yeah,
right. So,
but it's also like the RO is becoming in some cases a standard. But yeah. To be honest, it's not a perfect like solution. It has its like own drawbacks that we are sometimes fighting against. Yeah. So, but I guess that like the ecosystem around RO is growing, so I think that we should support it one way or another.
Knowing how things go with Trino, we'll be squashing those bugs for them on some occasions, I bet. Yeah. So.
Yeah, we're already pushing some of those things. I think this is a very good feedback from Saj. He's really excited as well. And I think he expresses all our thanks to you very well, Mateusz. Like, it's amazing what you do, and thank you so much for this and the ongoing and future work you're doing as well.
Thank you.
Cool. Anything else? I think this was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool to see such a massive change to Trino. Like, we're 10 plus years into the project, and it's like, yeah, we made this thing three times faster. Like, that's neat, radical. Like, you don't expect there to be such big wins, yeah, I think, this late in the game, but there's always more work to be done, which...
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised when I started benchmarking the protocol. I was like, I assumed that that would be like 20, 30% difference, not like some multiply, so...
Yeah, no, that's good. We like it.
Yeah, and that really will level Trino up. You know, it's for large-scale data retrieval. Like, yeah, it got way better. Like, not a little bit better, not a lot better, way better.
Yeah, so, it unlocks a lot of use cases that were not possible before. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to see those use cases and actually in the wild. So,
we'll probably be hearing about them at Trino Fest and Trino Summit later this year as the large-scale operations pick up on this and start leveraging it. I think they'll be excited, you know.
Yeah, so feedback is always welcome. If you have any ideas how to improve that, or some wishes, or some like some general comments how to improve the protocol, I'm like all ears. So,
all right, cool. Thank you so much. I think that's a wrap. Thank you everyone for joining us today. This was amazing. We, as I mentioned, have another episode coming up in 2 weeks about the preview UI and then about the Faker connector later. We also have contributor calls, so there's always something happening. Check out the Trino site, join us on Slack, and cheerio, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning into the Trino Community Broadcast, brought to you by Starburst Data.